Last week, we looked at some difficult passages in Old Testament law, right? The topics we were dealing with last week are frankly, some of the most difficult topics for Christians to understand about the Bible. Some of the passages that we looked at are things that will turn certain people away from believing that the Bible is God's Word. Yet, I believe that we saw in that sermon that there are reasonable responses to the questions that come up when you read some of those passages. If you missed that sermon, you can jump on the website later this week and listen to that. Now, in that sermon, one of my suggestions for you on how to handle difficult passages within Old Testament law was to step back and take a look at all of the evidence about the truth of the Bible before you make a decision on it. So don't stop and make a final judgment about whether the Bible can be true or not after hitting a passage or two that are difficult for you to understand. Make sure you're coming to your decision about the Bible after looking at all of the evidence. That was my suggestion. And I said last week that if we had had time in that sermon, which we didn't, that you know we could look together at this full body of evidence. But since there wasn't time for that, I just encourage you to come and meet with me in the office sometime if you ever wanted to look at that stuff. And I've made that statement to you a few times, that if you ever want to come and look at the evidence for Christianity, that you'd come and talk to me in my office. We've looked at some snippets of evidence over my, here and there in sermons over my 3 years with you now, but we've never done an entire sermon focused on that. And so I decided this week, I was thinking about those things, and especially since we're coming off a week where we've looked at some of these most difficult Bible passages, that maybe now would be an appropriate time for us to take a good look at the evidence that supports the conclusion that the real God has been at work in history and that the Bible is his book. So rather than asking you this time to come and meet with me in the office, it's going to be our task now over the next 2 weeks, this will be a two-parter, to look at the evidence for the truth of Christianity. If you've been attending here a while, you've probably figured this out about me, that this is kind of a topic of great interest to me. I enjoy thinking about these things. They're important to me. I've done a fair amount of reading on it. So you recognize that about me. Let me tell you something that I also recognize, and that is that not everybody gets excited about this topic. I know that. I know that. Some people just believe in Jesus, and they don't need to take a long look at the logical arguments for and against. Many of us have had experiences of the living God, and so maybe you're feeling, you know what? I don't need to look at that stuff because I know already. I know. And that's fine, of course. So if that's you and you're hearing me announce what our topic's going to be for the next two sermons and you're not into that stuff, maybe you're not real jazzed about these sermons either. No problem. I get it. But let me say this to you. You know, there are a lot of people for whom this evidence stuff is important. There are many people who need to be convinced by logical thinking and evidence in order to come to faith in the Bible, or at least that will be part of their process in coming to faith. And we should be able to understand their desire to make sure that what they are believing in is actually true, right? We hire inspectors when we're looking at buying a house because we don't want to just go on the word of the sellers about what the condition of that house is, right? So we hire inspectors to check these things out. We want to believe things that are true. And this is all the more vital when we're talking about something as important as Christianity. So some people really do just need a long look at the evidence as part of their process to coming to faith in God. And I think that fact means that we all at least ought to have a basic idea of what some of this evidence is, or at least to know that this material is out there. It may not matter to you much personally, but it may matter to someone to whom you are talking to, a friend that you're talking to about Christianity. So that'll be our task again today and in the next sermon. Two 30-minute sermons looking at evidence that supports the Bible as being the true Word of God. Now remember, entire books are written about this subject, and so we won't be able to be as exhaustive as we could be, but I will do my best to give you some main points. Some of the things I'll say today you will have heard me say before, some will be new, and I ought to say at the beginning here that for much of the material that I'll present to you this week and in the second sermon as well, I am greatly indebted to books like The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, Letters from a Skeptic by Greg Boyd, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, and a lot of other books oh boy, it goes all the way back to Josh McDowell and Evidence That Demands a Verdict, right? And all of these books that they've, what I've read there is kind of all jumbled together in my head. So I'm not even going to try to give an actual reference for each point that I bring up today that was not originally mine. I'm just going to give you a blanket credit to these authors right now. I want to start our effort today by telling you a little story that I've actually told it to you before, but it's been a couple years, so I think I can probably get away with saying it again. It's a little imaginary story that I think describes our situation, the situation that we find ourselves in quite nicely. So picture yourself staying in a secluded cabin in the northern Minnesota woods. You've gone up for a week to get away from life as normal and to clear your brain and take a break. One sunny day, you decide to go take a hike, so you grab your walking stick and your backpack and you head out. And it's quite secluded where you are, so you're going for 30 minutes or so and you haven't seen anybody or anything. And then you see something on the side of the path. Now, for this story to work, you have to imagine with me now that cameras have never been invented, okay? Will you go with me on that? Cameras have never been invented. You look down on the path before you and you pick up what we would know today to be a digital camera. But of course, you don't know what it is because cameras haven't been invented yet. You pick it up, turn it over in your hand, study it. You see that there are some buttons on it, but you can't seem to get it to do anything. So you throw it in your backpack and you head back to your cabin. When you arrive, you continue to be fascinated by this object that you found, and you know it has to do something, right? Well, you just happen to be a terrifically good mechanical engineer, and you decide you're going to spend your time now figuring this little object out. So you take it apart, and you study it. After a few hours of looking at what connects to what and testing various theories, you think you've discovered why it's not doing anything. That there's this little piece within the object that appears to perhaps have been jostled out of alignment, maybe when it fell on the ground. And so you put it back where it looks like it's supposed to go. Pretty soon, you hit a button, and on the back side of this little box, you see an image of the inside of your cabin. A moment frozen in time. We would know it today as a picture. So, oh, that's what this thing does. It takes pictures, even though I don't know what that word is. So the design within this little box that you picked up on the ground in the woods is incredible. Yeah, it wasn't working correctly, but even when it wasn't working correctly, you could see how it was supposed to work. You could figure it out, and you could get it back into alignment. And once you were able to put that piece back where it was supposed to go, the camera worked great. Well, the next big question for you then is, who designed this thing? It's amazing. This object I found has a function. It has an intricate design with a purpose of accomplishing that function. And on top of that, it's even somewhat attractive. It was clearly built with some attention to style and designed to be pleasing to look at and to hold. So who designed this thing? Obviously, there has to be a designer. I would argue that the situation we find ourselves in life is very similar to this little story about finding a camera in the woods. All around us, we are surrounded by plants and animals and human beings, even particular parts of plants and animals and human beings that all display an incredibly intricate and complex design. These beings and their parts have function and purpose. You know, people in the medical field today are in the role of this person in our story who found the camera. What medical people do is, one, they learn the human body and how it works, how it's designed to work. Two, they observe the ways in which the body can become broken, sickness, disease, malfunction. And then three, they try to fix what was broken, right? What doctors don't do is come up with new ways for the body to function. They are all about just getting the body back in working order, getting it back to doing what it was originally designed to do. So just like the person monkeying around with the camera found in the woods, the design and the function there is already built in. So our conclusion when we study the human body or really anything in this world, animals, plants, ecosystems, the sun and the moon, things out in space, our response is the same. There has to be a designer. There's just so much evidence of design and function. One more point to draw from this little story about the camera. We said that the camera had been designed with some flair and some style. Function wasn't the only concern for the person who made it. There was concern for how it looked. We find that concern also obviously reflected in the world around us. One day when I was back in my 20s, I returned home to my house and found that a little bird had flown into one of the windows and had died and was lying dead on the ground. So I grabbed some paper towel and I was going to put it in the garbage. But before I threw it away, I looked at it for a while. Function and design were quite evident there. Wings, feathers, beak, eyes, legs, and claws. But what stuck out to me the most when I was looking at this little bird was this. Its entire body was gray, except for one part, running down the from the top of its head to its neck area was one bold streak of bright yellow against the backdrop of all that gray. And looking at it up close, I was struck by the beauty of it. Could there really be an evolutionary explanation for why that streak of yellow would be there? Does a streak of yellow wind up on a little bird's head due to the random movements of unconscious matter? I don't think so. You know, I wonder that about zebras too. That striking black and white pattern, right? Tell me what the evolutionary reason is for that. I can't think of one. So the yellow streak standing out against all the gray on that bird, this is the touch not just of a designer, this is the touch of an artist, isn't it? A being who is interested in beauty. And we know, of course, that there is beauty to be found all over this planet we live on. So there has to be a designer. And I would argue, based on the things we can observe in our world, that this designer must be a mind-like being. We see purpose, we see intention, we see touches of an artist. I'd argue that the designer must be a mind-like, intentional being. So this is my first point for you this morning. From the evidence found in nature, I believe that the most reasonable conclusion to draw is that there has to be a powerful, mind-like, intentional being out there who has created the design, function, and beauty we see all around us. We can't see this designer, but even so, the evidence supports the designer's existence. And this is the same conclusion that the person who found the camera in the woods came to, right? There has to be a designer. Okay, it would be a very fair next question then, just based on the evidence that we can find in observing nature, to wonder if that designer is good or not. We experience and see a lot of good in this life. We experience and see a lot of pain and a lot of evil in this life as well. In fact, we just talked about how medical doctors are always trying to get our bodies to be working the way they were originally designed. So the question comes up, why are they always breaking down? There's pain, there's discomfort in this. Why? Did the amazing designer design our bodies to sometimes work and to sometimes not work? Does he not care about all the pain? So if you're just going from nature, this is a fair question, isn't it? Is this great designer that we see evidence of, is he morally good? Years ago, there was a TV show on CBS called Judging Amy. Maybe some of you will remember it. This is going back a ways. I think I only watched two or three episodes of this show in my life, but there was a conversation in one of those episodes that has stuck in my memory banks. The main character on the show, whose name is Amy, she was a judge, judging Amy. She had been facing especially challenging circumstances in her life. And in this one particular episode, a coworker of hers suggested to her that she might find some peace by going to church with him sometime. Amy kind of gave him a bad time about his invitation and suggested, no, I don't think I'm really interested in that. But he kept after her, and finally she engaged him a little more seriously on the topic and what ended up being the final scene of that episode. Amy asked her friend, "Okay, so tell me, why do you go to church?" And he said to her this, "Amy, the way I figure it, there are three options. One is that there is no God. The second is that there is a God, but that he just doesn't give a rip about all the pain going on down here. The third option is that there is a good God out there who does care, and I need to give him the benefit of the doubt on why all the tragedy goes on around us. I choose option number three." Well, she shot back at him, "But why? What makes you believe that that option is the right one?" And he responded, "When I look into my little girl's eyes when I tuck her in at night, I just know." So this man was using his experience of creation, in this case, the beauty of his little girl's eyes, but not just the beauty, right? This was the experience of interacting with another human soul, the soul and spirit and personality of his daughter, the meaning that he felt in his relationship to her and his interactions with her. He used those experiences to come to the conclusion that we have already been asserting here this morning, there has to be a designer. And not only that, but this designer has to be morally good. You know, it's true that I cannot keep my daughters from experiencing pain as they go through life in this world. They will experience pain here. I know it as much as I would like to keep them from it, and we'll try. I could conclude then that the designer must not be morally good if he would allow my daughters to go through pain. But you know what? I agree with the guy on TV. When I look into my daughter Maya's eyes, when I tuck her in at night and I experience all that she is at the grand old age of three, when I see how she has been created and I experience the light in her spirit, I just know that the one who has created her has to be a morally good being. He has to be. The one who created that, yeah, he's good. I know it. I can't prove it to you, of course. But it's just something I feel very strongly. The designer has to be morally good. The pain that comes in life must come from some reason other than that the designer doesn't care. You could add to this internal conviction of mine the fact that most people everywhere have felt within them a sense of right and wrong. C.S. Lewis and others talk about a universal moral code, right? That is felt and communicated among all people groups throughout all eras. And again, this would be evidence that the one who designed us is morally good. So I'm going to call this point 1.5. All right, it's a modification of our first point. From the evidence found in nature, I believe that the most reasonable conclusion to draw is that there must be a powerful, mind-like, intentional being out there who has created the design, function, and beauty we see all around us, and that this being, most likely, is morally good. These are, in my mind, the conclusions that we can draw just from observing nature about the possible existence of a God or a designer. So now, I go in search of that designer. I go in search of that designer. And as I start my search, I've already defined what it is I'm looking for. I'm looking now for more evidence beyond what we can see in the design and nature, more evidence for the existence of a powerful, mind-like, intentional, and probably morally good designer. Oh, where to look? Well, this designer created a race of human beings who can communicate with each other. Stands to reason he might have communicated with his creation at some point or another. So I'm going to go hunting. I'm going to go hunting to see if there are testimonies out there from people, whether from today or from the past, testimonies of interactions with a mind-like, personal creator God. Has this designer communicated with us at some point? Now, I could go buy a Volkswagen van and hop in it and try to visit every individual person who is living today who has a claim to have interacted with God. I could do that. I feel a little safer starting my search, and this would be a far more practical method, by beginning to look at the major world religions. We'll do the Volkswagen van later. The major world religions involve claims about ultimate things, God things. They have many adherents. Is it possible that one of these religions is the real deal? So let's start there. And here I actually need to bypass something that we should do here. The next logical step, of course, is to take a detailed look at the claims of each major world religion and to see if they have as part of their story the type of communication from the designer that I'm looking for. That's just way too much, even in a two-part sermon, to handle. So what we're going to do instead is go straight to that type of analysis of one of the major world religions, and that would be Christianity. What are the claims about the divine in Christianity? Does Christianity have as part of its story testimony of an historical experience with a being similar to what we are theorizing the designer must look like? Christianity grows out of Judaism, and we here know that Judaism and Christianity, we know those religions well enough to know that there are indeed claims in these religions of interactions between human beings and what definitely could be described as a designer God who is powerful, mind-like, intentional, and morally good. So, when we come to Christianity, unlike some of the other religions, we find that we are in the ballpark now of what we've been hunting for. We're in the ballpark, but have we hit a home run? These are just claims. Just like the person trying to sell us a house, claims about the condition of their house, we need to investigate. Are the claims of interactions with the divine within Christianity credible? Is it possible to ascertain truth here? Are the claims genuine? How can we even do this? How can we know if this was really God or not? Well, I think you just have to dive in and start looking and see where it takes you. In an analysis of Christianity, you might start out with the claims of interactions with God from the ancient Israelites, which actually is something that we've been doing over the last few weeks in our look at Old Testament law. The Israelites did exist, of course. We're dealing with a historical people here, not a made-up people group. An analysis of their claims would certainly take a good note of the Ten Commandments, right? The greatest and most profound moral code ever written down in human history. Well, that's worth noticing. If the Israelite interactions with God were genuine, you would expect to see some things like that. Your analysis of the Israelite writings would uncover more remarkable things like that. Many things that might suggest that these recorded experiences did indeed come from a genuine interaction with a real God. But we also find in the Israelite record of their conversations with God, as we saw last Sunday, elements of their story that make us question whether or not it could come from the morally good designer we're seeking. These passages that are so violent, slavery, devaluation of women, those kinds of things. There's a lot in those writings that looks quite a bit like the greater culture that lived around the Israelites. Now, I pointed out last Sunday that in the midst of the things in the Old Testament that look a lot like the greater culture that the Israelites lived in, there still is enough difference in the moral thinking and the thinking about God that came out of Israel that, in my opinion, an honest analysis would come to the conclusion that it must at least be possible, and we're just looking at evidence now, it must at least be possible that a God was involved in Old Testament Israel. Even when it comes to these things in the Old Testament that look a lot like the cultures around Israel, there is still difference to be found. There is significant advancement in morality. But you know, these Old Testament documents we're talking about here are ancient writings from an ancient society, things that are hard to corroborate historically, things that occurred at a time before anybody cared about journalistic accuracy in historical writings. Just those convictions just hadn't even come into the human consciousness yet at that time. So I think a person who's searching for evidence of interactions with a personal, mind-like creator God would walk away from the Old Testament scriptures with mixed feelings. Some things there seem godly. Some things make you wonder, but all of it in the end is just difficult to draw a conclusion from on a basis of a look at the evidence. However, the core of an analysis of Christianity will not come from a look at the Old Testament. It will surround a long look at the person for whom the religion is named after, a look at Jesus Christ. And when we start to look at Jesus and the claims being made about him, and the correspondence that was written about him, we begin to discover things that will really get our evidence-collecting wheels turning. A first step in analysis of evidence specifically about Jesus now is to apply some thinking to the documents that contain his story, the Gospels and the books that follow them in the New Testament. Are these documents trustworthy? In answer to that, I'll give you now my second point for today, and that is this. The New Testament documents were written at about the time that humanity started caring about detailed accuracy and about eyewitness testimony in their historical writings. The New Testament documents were written at about the time that humanity started caring about detailed accuracy and about eyewitness testimony in their historical writings. It was still quite a ways off from our convictions from today, but it was a whole lot better than what had come before it. A doctor named Luke, who became a follower of Christ in the months after Jesus was crucified, wrote these words at the beginning of what we now call the Gospel of Luke in our Bibles. Many of us have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us about Jesus, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you've been taught. All right, so Luke is writing his gospel to a person named Theophilus, and we see in his comments here some concern for accuracy that is part of journalistic standards today. And this should matter to us if we are analyzing documents written by human beings who say they've had an experience with God. We're looking for reasons to believe or to reject their claims. Luke says that these stories he's about to relay to Theophilus have been handed down to him from eyewitnesses. The stories that he's writing down are not about events that happened hundreds of years earlier that are now just getting written down. These are stories that happened right in that era. Luke was a contemporary to these people. He was not an eyewitness himself, but he's talking to eyewitnesses, carefully investigating, he says, all these things. Now, that's the kind of stuff I'm looking for when I'm on a search for a record of an experience with God. Eyewitness testimony, careful investigation, these things matter to me. And Luke's account is, of course, not all there is in the Bible, right? We have an eyewitness who wrote the Gospel of John. We have other books, like the books ascribed to Peter, eyewitness. The main author in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, was intimately familiar with the men and women who had followed Jesus daily as his disciples. So this is now what we are dealing with when it comes to the New Testament documents. And all of these people who are telling us of their experiences with a man named Jesus Christ in these documents are united in the belief and the assertion that he was nothing less than the Son of God. They believe that the Creator God himself had been communicating to the world through Jesus and through the events they had witnessed. These are claims of people having heard from the true designer through the man Jesus Christ. So point number two for you today in our weighing of the evidence for the truth of the Bible has been that these New Testament documents were written at about the time that humanity started caring about detailed accuracy and about eyewitness testimony in their historical writings. God knew when the best time was to unveil the next part of his plan. Point number three is a related point. It's a very important point. It's also our final point for part one of our two-part quest here to analyze the evidence surrounding the truth of the Bible. And that point is this. The New Testament documents should be considered generally historically reliable. The New Testament documents should be considered generally historically reliable. In the past few decades, there have been stories that have hit magazines, shows on PBS and on the History Channel that have been written from the viewpoint that the New Testament documents should not be considered to be historically reliable. Now, my first impulse generally is to have some trust for the most part for what I see on PBS. I believe there are a lot of intelligent people working in public television. That was for Ben's benefit, by the way. Yeah. But even PBS is not worthy of blind trust, and let me tell you what I mean. Back in 1985, there was a scholar named Robert Funk. He gathered up a group of Bible specialists from a variety of places, and they decided together that they were going to go through the Gospels and the Bible and vote on the sayings of Jesus as to whether or not Jesus had actually said those things. They were going to decide this. They had some criteria laid out for the types of Jesus' sayings that would be considered authentic and the types of Jesus' sayings that would not. And then they got together and conducted their vote. And the result was that in the Jesus Seminar's judgment, this was the name, that was the name of this group, the Jesus Seminar's judgment, very little of what Jesus is recorded as saying in the Bible was actually said by him. Oh, the press ate it up. Made the cover of Newsweek and Time. Jesus hardly said any of the things in the Bible. That's big news. Shows were run on PBS that supported the Jesus Seminar's beliefs. And I've watched shows in more recent years that still come from that viewpoint, that the New Testament documents cannot be trusted. But you need to understand that these scholars came into that project with strong biases. There are a number of things I could bring up here to show you that, but I'll just bring up one example for you. The Jesus Seminar approached their project there with the presupposition that miracles cannot happen, that miracles cannot happen. Therefore, when they voted, anything in Jesus' sayings that referred to a miracle as having occurred was put under the heading, Jesus did not actually say this. If it was talking about a miracle, he could not have really have said it because miracles don't exist. Therefore, he didn't really say it. This is the thinking of the Jesus Seminar. How do you feel about their methodology? Do you feel that miracles are impossible? And there are other examples I could show you about the bias built into this voting process. This is the type of approach these people had. It was deeply flawed, but it got picked up by the media and spread to many people who, like me, have a general trust for what they hear on PBS. It's damaging stuff. Incorrect thinking, but accepted by the masses because it came from scholars. The work of the Jesus Seminar has been exposed for what it was in great books like Cynic, Sage, or Son of God, and The Jesus Quest. But even though the thinking in these books is clearly superior, these books don't get the press, you know. Greg Boyd wrote Cynic, Sage, or Son of God, and one of his main points there is that if you take the normal historical criteria that historians use for judging the reliability of written works of history, and you apply those normal criteria to the New Testament books, the books pass with flying colors. But scholars like Robert Funk and his Jesus Seminar colleagues didn't, they don't like to come at the Gospels with the normal criteria. They want to add their own. Boyd says that's not the right way to approach it. You know, it doesn't even mean you have to believe in the New Testament or that you have to believe that miracles can happen, but at least come at these works the way you come at everything else that you're analyzing. Apply the same standards and then look at the results and make your own personal decision about whether you believe what the New Testament is teaching or not. So we need to now just take a brief look at what this normal criteria for evaluating historical works actually is and see how the New Testament holds up to it, and this will be our last task for the morning. So I'm leaning again on Greg Boyd here. I won't give you everything he lists out in his discussion of normal criteria, but I'll give you a few points. Here is one piece of criteria that historians use for evaluating the truth of historical books. Was the author in a position to know what he or she was writing about? Was it an eyewitness account or based on an eyewitness account? We've already made that point this morning. These books were written by eyewitnesses or by contemporaries of eyewitnesses to the events they record. Remember the details in John's gospel, how John outran Peter to the tomb, right? There's a lot of that stuff to be found in the New Testament documents. Generally speaking, the authors of the New Testament books were certainly in a position to know what they were writing about. Here's another criteria used by historians in evaluation. Does the document contain self-damaging material? Does the document contain self-damaging material? So the idea here is that if the document was completely made up, why would the author ever put something in it that seemed to contradict what his main assertions were? And again, on this point, Boyd says the New Testament documents meet this criteria. Given the view of women in that day and age, Boyd says you never would have written that women were the first people to discover that Jesus had been resurrected if you were making the story up. You would have had men discover this. In that culture, listing women as the as the first to discover the resurrected Jesus would be considered self-damaging material. Another example would be Jesus yelling from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why in the world would you ever have written that down for any reason other than that's what he actually said? So yes, there is self-damaging material in the New Testament. On the flip side, the next criteria to look at in evaluating historical works is the document reasonably self-consistent? Is it reasonably self-consistent? Hey, we've read the gospel accounts here, and the answer is yes, right? There are different authors, and there are some differing details that come out in the different accounts. But the overall picture of the story of who Jesus was and what he did and what he said is very consistent. A last one for you. Another question that historians ask is, were there people at the time who could have refuted what is being claimed in the writing being evaluated if it were false? And would those people have had a motive to do so? Were there people at the time who could have refuted what is being claimed in the writing being evaluated if it were false? And would those people have had a motive to do so? And the answer is yes and yes. There were plenty of people around who could have written a document refuting the Christian claims if the claims were obviously false. And there were also plenty of people around during that time who would have loved to snuff out Christianity. They were trying to snuff out Christianity. So yes, there was motivation to write a refutation, yet no such document has been found. Things like this, says Greg Boyd, support our point number 3 for today, that the New Testament documents should be considered generally historically reliable. So if you see a show on PBS telling you that they are not, don't buy it. Okay, so this is where we're going to stop for today. We're only halfway through our look at the evidence for the truth of Christianity. There's much more to come. In closing, let's summarize what we've discussed so far. There is great evidence to be found in nature of a powerful, mind-like, intentional creator out there who is most likely, again, just looking at the evidence from nature here, most likely morally good. So has that creator communicated to humanity in ways other than through the observation of his works of his hand in nature? We begin the search for more evidence for this God. A look at the evidence to be found in the Old Testament writings within Christianity turns up mixed results. All of it's very ancient and hard to corroborate. It's a bit inconclusive, but when you shift over to the New Testament, it's a different story. We've seen today that the New Testament documents were written at about the time that humanity started caring about detailed accuracy and about eyewitness testimony in their historical writings, and we've seen today that the New Testament documents should be considered generally historically reliable. These are both points in favor of those who are claiming to have made contact with the Creator God through the man Jesus Christ. And in my next sermon to you, we will discover that these two points are not the only points supporting the claims of the Christ followers. So we'll look at those things and draw some implications from this material for our lives when we get to part 2 of our look at the evidence in favor of the truth of Christianity. Let's pray, shall we? Lord Jesus, I used a little story about a camera as an illustration today. You had your own illustration that you used in a conversation with Nicodemus back when you walked this earth so long ago. You said that you can't see the wind, but you can see the effects of the wind. Lord, you have not made it possible for us in our situation right now to see you face to face, but everywhere around us, we can see the effects of your creativity, your ability to design and to create. We see the effects of your Spirit. It becomes clear through a reading of Scripture, Lord, that you are very careful not to force us to choose you. You want us to freely choose you. So it will come down to taking a step of faith. Yet you have not left us without reasons to believe in you. There is evidence. There's evidence to lead us to accepting the Bible as true. Lord, you taught that those who truly seek you will find you. You are available for those who are truly looking. May we all here come looking, Father. Thank you for your wisdom, your greatness. Thank you for the incredible creation that we get to experience and live in this world. It's amazing. You are great and greatly to be praised. Amen.